the spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kaba Tahway. On Saturday, the Yemeni army issued a warning against the UAE, one of the partners in the Saudi alliance in the war on Yemen. The United Arab Emirates, UAE, should await a harsh response for its escalations against Yemen. It reminded the Persian Gulf country that Abu Dhabi's fragile glass towers are, quote, easy to reach. That reach was executed just 2 days later. Yemen's army launched drone attacks deep inside the UAE. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the UAE and Saudi Arabia, for that matter, will change course in this war or continue with their failed offensives.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab al-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Hossein Al-Hukaiti joining us from Sana'a. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both, and Hossein Abouqaiti, let me first start with you. You had a warning that was issued by the Yemeni army, and then two days later, Abu Dhabi was hit. Drone attacks deep inside the UAE, three fuel tankers in this incident, and it took place in your storage facilities of the ADNOC, which is the oil firm of the UAE. Tell us how significant this is, and tell us why the Yemeni army decided to choose this time for it to execute this attack.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. They have chosen this time because the United Arab Emirates have declared a long time ago that they have withdrawn from Yemen and they are not involved in the war. But actually, in the recent week, United Arab Emirates has extended its attack and its strike on Yemen. They have resumed their attack. Hundreds of airstrikes targeted Yemeni civilians in Shabwa region. And United Arab Emirates' role in Yemen is no different than Saudi Arabia. But on the top of that, they actually supporting separatists. They're trying to divide Yemen, controlling Yemeni island and some of the coast of Yemen, building air base there. So United Arab Emirates' goal is to divide Yemen, and then they will try to be, or they are actually a tool of the United States and the Zionist state of Israel. What's new about this latest attack on the United Arab Emirates that comes after 3 or 4 days after Yemeni official here in Sana'a have warned United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their attack that they will be under a target. And as Yahya Sari', the spokesperson of Yemeni army, he have declared United Arab Emirates as unsafe state, and he has as well called foreign company to leave the country, because at one point Yemeni army will target Abu Dhabi airport directly and will target many industrial area in United Arab Emirates. We have seen that United Arab Emirates has admitted that attack because I believe they could not hide it as they did when Yemeni forces 3 years ago have targeted Abu Dhabi airport. United Arab Emirates have denied at that time, but then Sana'a has released CCTV footage from the airport that shows that attack. And this is the first time Yemeni army used a ballistic missile to target, as they say, Abu Dhabi airport and Dubai airport, including as well refinery and other sensitive and important area in United Arab Emirates. That's why I believe that United Arab Emirates is still hiding some of the damage that have been done today by Yemeni attack.
Sure, that has actually been reflected in some media outlets. But Elijah Magner, our guest, talked about how one of the reasons, anyways, for the attack is that the UAE announced a few years back, a couple years ago, that it was withdrawing from the war in Yemen. That its strategy in that war has changed, and it announces the end of its direct military engagement there. Why do you think that the UAE would do that and yet continue with this war while it's still evident that it's participating, and at the same time it was at least covered in a way where it said it was a fatal blow to its relationship to Saudi Arabia?
This is a very good question. Actually, the Emirates have said that in the past, and not only after the attack on the Emirates, we saw the Stockholm Agreement coming out in 2018, establishing a ceasefire and redeployment of forces because they were critical to each humanitarian crisis. The second point of the Stockholm Agreement was the opening humanitarian corridor to allow to facilitate the freedom of movement of civilian and goods. And the last point is the prisoner swap. So nothing has changed. We haven't seen very little of prisoner swap, and we've seen very little of ceasefire, redeployment of forces, and humanitarian corridor. The siege is still established against Yemen, and the Emirates did not respect the Stockholm Agreement, and it's pushed by the Saudis to continue the war because the Saudi insists, notwithstanding all the losses they on the Saudi economy and on losing on the ground with all its mercenaries. So because the Emirates jumped in again, then the Houthis warned the Emiratis that there is a price for what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And the Houthis' warning was very serious. We've seen it today. But what is very surprising is how the world jumped on one attack against the Emirates when on the same day there were 38 attacks from the Saudis and coalition against Yemen. So there is really that is balanced on the mainstream media, and the war in Yemen is looked at from only one angle, against the Yemeni,
sure,
and in favor of the Saudis. At the end of the day, the Saudis and Yemeni are occupying Yemen. They should leave.
Well, that's a very good point that you make. The fact that you have 38 attacks take place, Hussein Bokhesi, our guest, talking about that, and you know, that's not covered, where you have this one attack and you have a blitz of media coverage on this. Do you think that that is because of the fact that UAE is small? It's a haven for what you have, the presence of foreign investors, real estate sectors, and basically port exports, and just all different foreigners and expats in that small island. You have the world somewhat engaged in one way or another with that island. And that is why you have the coverage that you have, which at this point, this particular attack may actually threaten overall its economy.
Yes, I mean, if you see that United Arab Emirates, its economy and its industry, its focus on Dubai and Abu Dhabi. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will continue its attack, United Arab Emirates will be affected more than Saudi Arabia, because we know the size of Saudi Arabia is big, and as well, United Arab Emirates depend 95% of its economy on the export of oil, and the other 5% is on tourists, and there are millions of foreigners who live in United Arab Emirates, tens of thousands of foreign company. That's why we have seen as well, if you check the so-called flight radar app, you're going to see there are less flight on United Arab Emirates. Just 1 hour ago, there were two flights, one from Doha and one from Istanbul, has actually directed its flight away from Abu Dhabi Airport. And this means that the damage that has been done to the airport, and maybe the companies and flight companies will think again to use that airport and as well Dubai Airport. That's why I believe more attack against United Arab Emirates, against its airport, against its economy, it will bring it to its knee faster than Saudi Arabia, and then Yemeni army will be actually able to liberate more areas in Yemen. And just one final thing, I have seen in many media, outside media especially, they call that today attack as an escalation. They have forgot that Yemen is under attack for more than 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been killed. The blockade, the constant attack on Yemeni industry, on Yemeni infrastructure. That's why we have come to a point, an eye for an eye. But even though Yemeni army is still careful in taking and deciding when to attack, and there was as well about 10 minutes ago two airstrike on Sana'a. That's why I believe the coming days we will see more attack against United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their war against Yemen.
Well, okay, I guess we do need to talk about this, Elijah Magnier. I mean, you know, our guest makes a very good point. You have a country that's being bombed rather continuously in the past 3 weeks. It has escalated this bombing campaign by Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition. And not to mention the past years that the country is experiencing not only the bombing campaign, civilian deaths, but the humanitarian aspect. But scant coverage, not only on that aspect of it, but the way that it gets twisted, as if this one attack that took place today is heightening or escalating the war. So the media is trying to twist this story towards the other side, isn't it?
Yes, of course. I mean, let's start from the Biden administration, when President Biden came to power and said he wants to stop the war in Yemen. And then he backed off on that, and he's no longer concerned about stopping the devastating war on Yemen and the huge, biggest ever humanitarian crisis that hit the country. Now, we see how the media is dealing with Yemen as the unforgotten war, and suddenly everybody remembers it when there is one or two or a dozen of attacks against Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, and they don't see the hundreds of attacks that are hitting Yemen for the last 7 years. That's really the way mainstream media is dealing with it, because they don't want to upset Saudi Arabia, because there is a lot of money involved from the Saudi in different countries, and because we see the United States, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, they all supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons to be used only against Yemen, because this is the only place that the Saudis are using their weapons, and they are very much aware of it, but they don't speak about it because they don't want to be involved in this humanitarian crisis, hiding behind their finger, not knowing that they are indeed responsible for every single crime against humanity that is committed in Yemen.
Well, we need to break this open in terms of the UAE role played in this war in Yemen, Hossein al-Bukhaiti. We know that it is part of the Saudi-led coalition at this point, involved in the bombing in one form or another. But there's another role that the UAE is playing that Saudi Arabia does not like. Break that open for us if you can. And that is how the UAE supports the Southern Transitional Council and its fighters, as opposed to the way that you have Saudi Arabia support what they call Yemen's President Rabah Mansour Hadi, which is not the case. Yemenis actually don't accept him or hold him legitimate. What is going on there? Why has there been a divergence there when it comes to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, particularly about the Southern Transitional Council?
The United Arab Emirates is a direct tool of United Kingdom, and we know that United Kingdom, it was occupying south of Yemen. That's why they have now more interest in the country. And as they say in England, or when they conquer in Yemen or other country, they say divide and conquer. And this is exactly what the United Arab Emirates is doing. I mean, United Arab Emirates role in Yemen is more dirtier than Saudi Arabia, because, I mean, if you were going to look at least Saudi, it says that support the so-called Hadi legitimacy, which is they call him as the president of Yemen. But on the other hand, we see that the United Arab Emirates is supporting those separatists. They are building airport. They are misusing and damaging Yemeni port. They are actually stealing fish from Yemen. They are stealing everything, especially as an example in Socotra. This means that they are actually want this war. They want to stay in Yemen. They want to divide Yemen, and as well they are fighting the so-called legitimacy or Hadi that they the many time in Aden and other area they have fought. They have used Al-Qaeda, they have used ISIS. So the role, if it's not like Saudi Arabia, actually is more, they are more involved in Yemen. And we've seen the amount of weapons that was handed by United Arab Emirates to the so-called the separatists in south of Yemen. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will extend its attack, especially against United Arab Emirates, I'm sure that United Arab is so weak, and it will bring it to its knee, and it will stop the war against Yemen. And we have seen those many condemnation today against this attack show you that over 200,000 airstrike on Yemen, there isn't any single condemnation, especially from the United Nations or any other country. Even though, I mean, we remember when they targeted the funeral hall in Sana'a, killing more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians and injuring more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians, United Nations has called it an incident. That's why Yemeni army should stop its attack despite what kind of condemnation coming from a country who actually selling weapons to United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
Sure. But I need to have Elijah Magner, you tell us about what is perhaps or most arguably one of the most underreported aspects of this war, and that is the goal that the UAE has had on Socotra Island, taking that over and then bringing on, after the formal announcement of the so-called normalization of ties with Israel, bringing Israel on board, making that island in what was reported to be a spying center. But aside from that, how that's going to connect that part, which is very strategic, to other ports, for example, in Africa, with Israel on the UAE's back. Tell us the relationship there that exists between the UAE, Israel, and the purpose Socotra Island and the ports serve for whatever intentions they have.
This is absolutely a very good question. Indeed, the role of the Emirates has been very noticed in the last years since the normalization with Israel and the intensive relationship that came to the surface. However, this relationship is not new. So what the Emiratis are doing in Yemen is really to protect the navigation and the interests of the Israelis in the island of Socotra and also on Bab el-Mandeb, because they are supporting 100% the Zionist regime. And they are acting on behalf of the interests of Israel in the Middle East and elsewhere. So if you look at the Emiratis per se, they have no interest in being in Yemen or expanding their forces and their presence to create an area of influence, because this is not a big country. It's a very small country based on a bit of business and wealthy people there. Mm-hmm. They have oil, and that's their role. And now they've taken upon the role of being the the shield for the Israelis, and the avant-garde of the Israeli interest in the Middle East, to really race any other country in the area of supporting Israel, hence their presence in Yemen for that purpose. And we see the visit they are coming, they are holding with the Iranians, thinking that they can compensate of their relationship with Israel. Well, the Iranians said it clearly, if you want to stop the war in Yemen, you have to go and talk to the Yemeni, accept a ceasefire and lift the siege and get out of the country, because this is not your country and you're occupying it. And it seems now with the Yemeni attack, perhaps the Emiratis got the message, and maybe it will serve them for another couple of years and stay away, as they've done after the Stockholm Agreement when they were bombed by the Houthis.
Okay, last question, Hossein Aboukhaiti. Did the UAE get the message, as our guests there said? Less than a minute.
With you, I don't think they will get the message, because today attack Yemeni forces have tried, I think, to avoid, as an example, to target the industrial site in Abu Dhabi directly, or as well to target the oil field. There are huge oil field like the so-called Zakam, and as well Bu Hasa and others. If Yemeni army, if United Arab Emirates will continue its war, I believe that those major oil sites will be under attack. And after that, United Arab Emirates and their reputation around the war as a hub for international companies will be destroyed. But we still, if they're going to do that and they're going to stop, there will be no more attack. But I don't think they will do that, only if Yemeni will hit hard inside United Arab Emirates.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Hossein Aboukhaiti from Sana'a there, activist and political analyst. Many thanks. And Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution from Brussels, journalist and political analyst. And that is it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikoa Tahwa, the entire team, this goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
لا تدعوا اليوم ثبورا واحدا وادعوا ثبورا كثيرا.
They will be told, do not cry this day for one destruction, but cry for much destruction.
In the previous program, we started discussing the 14th verse of the chapter. لا تدع اليوم ثبورا واحدا وادعوا ثبورا كثيرا. Call not this day for one destruction, but call for many destructions. So this verse is what is said to the pagans on the day of hereafter. It implies that wishing for destruction only once is not enough, and they must say it many times. Why? Because one crying and moaning does not have any result for them. There will be no death or destruction for them, and they must remain alive, experience their painful consequences of the misbehaviors and wrongdoings in the world in hereafter. Because that day is Yawmul Hisab. That day, their actions, their behaviors, their intentions in the world will be scrutinized. And we also mentioned the reason beyond this consequence that awaits them. In the 11th verse, it was mentioned, بَلْ كَذَّبُوا بِالسَّاعَةِ. They denied the hour of resurrection. وَأَعْتَدْنَا لِمَنْ كَذَّبَ بِالسَّاعَةِ سَعِيرًا. And thus we have prepared a blazing fire for the one who denies the hour. So ignoring Allah leads to desperate straits in this world and the other. This is exactly what the Holy Quran mentions. He makes his breast narrow and straightened. The Holy Quran says about the one who is forgetful of the Almighty Allah's remembrance. And a life which is straightened has been promised for these kinds of people who turn away from the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. This is what awaits the ones who are ignoring the Almighty Allah. On the contrary, paying attention to Allah and having faith in Him is the cause of calmness. It is the cause of peacefulness, both in this world and hereafter.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أنتم الفقراء
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The Holy Quran says, Barakat min as-samawati wal-ard. We would have certainly opened up for them blessings from the heaven and the earth. Also, about the other world and what rewards will be given to these people, the Holy Quran says, when they reach it, the gates thereof are opened. حَتَّى إِذَا جَاءُهَا فُتِحَتْ أَبْوَابُهَا. They don't even have to bother themselves opening up the doors of mercy and paradise. In another occurrence, the Holy Quran says, is one who follows the pleasure of Allah like him who incurs wrath from Allah and whose abode will be hell? And an evil destination it is. There has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth Imam, who said, the hell has got seven gates. From one of them, our enemies and those who fight and belittle us enter. And certainly this gate is the greatest and the most blazing one. And these people, based on our traditions, are miserable forever. The one who enters the hell is miserable forever. This is what our traditions suggest. The Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, the fire of this world is one part of the 70 parts of the hell fire, and each of those parts has got its own heat. He has further said, the least punishment of people of hell is wearing a blazing pair of shoes on the day of hereafter. These shoes are so hot that their brains begin to boil from them. And this is the kind of consequence that awaits the people who have belittled the religion of the Almighty Allah, who have belittled the prophets and the infallibles. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this regard, has said, fear the fire, the heat of which is too much, and its bottom is very deep, and its ornament is iron, and its beverage is boiling fetid water, which is blood mixed with filth. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We need to mention again that we have benefited a lot from the different versions of an enlightening commentary into the light of the Holy Quran available at al-islam.org. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles.
The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed, while a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place. Now the Philomoy School has opened for students in Afghanistan to facilitate learning. This Iranian platform provides Afghani students with free educational courses. Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses.
Hello everyone, how are you?
Now they are students of Philomoy School and they are happy with everything it has provided.
It has been almost 152 days that we have been away from school. We felt very desperate. In order to stay involved with education, my friends and I gather here and benefit from Philomo School's online courses. The lessons and videos provided by Philomo are very interesting and creative.
Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Philomo Online School very professional and useful for Afghani students.
I found the Philomo School extraordinarily useful, especially for Afghan students who are affected by a political crisis and the coronavirus pandemic. This is very valuable academically too. I'm sure our students highly welcome Philomo School because they are in need of such opportunities.
Philomo School says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl from preschool to the ninth grade can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Nakab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
There was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by Ben-Gurion in the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. and all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defense ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe costs in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, you know, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace. All of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led U.N. Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for a meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which I mean, a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively since last few years. Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS, and so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdullahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense, and the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. the two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Fuzhou.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer, do star jumps, or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous, because I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saipur is up, London.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, transmitting the problems and flaws of the spouse to others. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of transmitting the problems and flaws of the spouse to others in the family life and the challenges of the family. Now, when we look at the family life, we see that people do have many problems in their life, and they cannot cooperate with each other. They're having issues. And when we look at in depth and we do an in-depth study of the family relation, we find that the main issue is that the spouse, they transmit the problems and flaws of their spouses to others, maybe to their sisters, brothers, parents, friends or closer friends, or maybe the husband's friends or the wife's friend. So these are the main issues that whenever in a family, when a husband transmits the problems of her wife to her, for example, family members, or to his own family members or the friends, there the problems starts. On the other hand, it's the same, that if wife transmits the problems and the flaws of the husband to his family or maybe to her own family, there the issues starts. And we can see that when